any opportunity that members have, any reason they have to come together and build relationships, I think is also good for the institution long term.
Earmarks make a comeback in Congress. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, unvaccinated city employees in Bethel look for new jobs.
Money-wise, it's going to be hard, you know, until we find a job for me, you know.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, overlooking the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks, with 400 guest rooms and 17,000 square feet of meeting space. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Alaska USA has been on a journey with Alaskans since their first member account was opened in 1948. They'll be with you every step of the way, through the challenges of today and the hopes of tomorrow. AlaskaUSA.org. This message sponsored by Alaska USA.
Congress may or may not reach a deal on President Biden's social spending initiative, but one way or another, they have to pass appropriations bills to keep government funded. Senator Lisa Murkowski has issued a wish list of dozens of Alaska projects she's hoping will be in those appropriations bills. Her $230 million list and those of other senators marks the return of earmarking. But Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports that earmarks aren't what they used to be.
Murkowski's list has big items like nearly $28 million to expand the emergency room at Alaska Native Medical Center and about the same amount for a road between Kotzebue and a possible deepwater port site. It has small items like $50,000 to study harmful algae in Kodiak, and lots of clinics, research projects, and waterworks in between. It harkens back to the golden age of Alaska earmarks, when the late Senator Ted Stevens was on the Appropriations Committee. Steve Ellis, president of the nonpartisan Taxpayers for Common Sense, remembers those years well.
Certainly, Senator Stevens used his perch as chairman of the Appropriations Committee and a senior member of the Appropriations Committee to deliver a lot of federal taxpayer dollars back to Alaska.
Ellis says that era came to a close with a couple of big earmarking scandals and a big bridge, Alaska's so-called Bridge to Nowhere, which would have connected Ketchikan to the island where its airport is located. Taxpayers for Common Sense was among the groups that derided that as pork. The American public seemed to agree, and Republicans banned earmarks in 2010. And now Democrats have brought earmarks back with reforms. Now these home state projects are called congressionally directed spending. Ellis still sees potential for waste and abuse. He likes that the list of each lawmaker's earmark requests is now made public. No more secret earmarks. But Ellis says the leaders of the appropriations committees should provide the information in a searchable format.
Now, we wanted to be out of the database making business, and they certainly haven't done that.
Another big reform, Ellis notes, is that now earmarks can only go to government entities or nonprofits. That helps address the scandal of Duke Cunningham, a congressman caught selling earmarks in exchange for bribes. Ellis considers that an improvement.
So they've tried to remove that pay-to-play aspect out of earmarks, but there's still the challenge of, are you making decisions based on political muscle rather than policy merit?
Earmark defenders will tell you they don't necessarily increase government spending. Congress members use earmarks to carve up the federal pie and send slices home rather than leave the pie cutting to government bureaucrats. Some Congress watchers think earmarks help Congress function.
Yeah, so I am definitely of the mind that it helps more than it hurts.
Molly Reynolds is a Congress expert at the Brookings Institution. She says it's one of the jobs of Congress to decide how federal money is spent. And Reynolds says rank-and-file Congress members don't have as much say as they used to now that so many bills show up as big omnibus packages that don't come up through committees. Earmarks, Reynolds says, allow members to do good for their districts and to talk to each other, to talk up the merits of their earmark.
Any opportunity that members have, any reason they have to come together and build relationships, I think is also good for the institution long term.
So far, after a 10-year hiatus, earmarks have had, at best, limited success in bringing Congress together. Only 14 Republican senators took the opportunity that Murkowski did to request home state spending projects in the appropriations bills. Most of the Republican leadership did not, nor did Senator Dan Sullivan. A Sullivan spokesman said in an email that he uses other means to make the case for federal investment in Alaska. The email didn't say whether Sullivan opposes the practice of earmarking, and in a Capitol hallway, Sullivan wouldn't take any questions.
Liz, I'm late for a meeting.
Oh,
I'm late for a vote.
Can I just ask? On the House side, Alaska Congressman Don Young is a big fan of earmarks. He says when Congress gave them up, they essentially handed power over to the executive branch. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Nicholas Begich III has filed federal paperwork to run for Alaska's sole U.S. House seat, the same seat once held by his grandfather, Congressman Nick Begich.
What I've been hearing from Alaskans is that they're ready to look forward into the future.
Also in the race, Congressman Don Young, the only person to represent Alaska in the U.S. House since Congressman Begich disappeared on a flight to Juneau in 1972. Unlike his grandfather, the 44-year-old Begich is a Republican. He was a chairman of Congressman Young's campaign in 2020. Begich's campaign manager for his U.S. House run is Truman Reed, who was Young's campaign manager in 2020 and worked in his congressional office. Begich says he hasn't discussed with Young the idea that the congressman would step aside and consider Begich a good successor. He calls it a possibility.
There's an eventuality here as well. I mean, at some point, you know, the congressman at 88 years old has served the state for nearly 50 years. And I think folks recognize that there's a limit to the amount of time left for him to do so.
Young's campaign did not respond to emailed questions. Young filed for re-election this summer and has nearly $500,000 in his campaign account. Begich is the executive chairman of a software development company and lives in Chugiak. Also in the 2022 race, Greg Brelsford, Shannon Scott Evans, and Randy Parham, all Republicans. ExxonMobil has agreed to transfer operating responsibility for the Point Thompson field on the North Slope to Hilcorp. Point Thompson, on state land east of Prudhoe Bay, is a large reservoir of natural gas and gas condensate. ExxonMobil Alaska Public Affairs Manager Hans Neidig says Exxon will maintain its 60% ownership in the field.
ExxonMobil remains committed to Point Thompson and will continue to have a leadership role in exploring all options to monetize its gas resources.
Neidig said Exxon will also maintain its ownership stake in Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. He said he expects Hilcorp will hire most or all of the 38 Exxon employees who operate Point Thompson. Point Thompson was the first and only North Slope field that Exxon operated. Hilcorp became the main oil field operator in the state after it bought BP's Alaska assets last year. Production of condensate from Point Thompson began in 2016. Commercial production of Point Thompson gas will depend on a large liquefied natural gas system. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a retreating glacier opens up a hydropower opportunity.
If you went and visited the glacier 2 years in a row and stood right next to it, it'd be pretty obvious that it was different.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Seward Peninsula Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss proposals to change federal subsistence hunting and trapping regulations and other subsistence-related issues, and invites public participation at a meeting October 26th and 27th via teleconference. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Yukon Flats school district officials say they'll talk further with 8 district employees who so far have failed to comply with a policy requiring all district workers to get COVID-19 vaccinations. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Superintendent Debbie Lancaster says even before the Fort Yukon-based school district board voted last month to adopt a COVID vaccination mandate, nearly 9 in 10 of its 90 employees had already gotten the shot.
At the time of the adoption, about 80 to 90% of our staff was already vaccinated.
Lancaster says the district had increased its vaccination rate by a few percentage points by Tuesday, the 30-day deadline set by the board. But she said 4 teachers and 4 classified employees still had not gotten the shot, so district officials want to talk with them about that.
The remaining unvaccinated staff are being asked to leave their post to participate in conferences to determine why they're not vaccinated and to explore all options to be considered in moving forward.
Lancaster says they've not been fired, as the rumor mill has it. And she says those rumors were intensified after a conservative blogger posted that erroneous information on the must-read Alaska blog site.
No, not at all. Not since the day I got here in July 1st. I've not recommended termination for anyone.
But district officials strongly believe in the importance of vaccinations, as shown in the board's unanimous vote adopting the mandate.
The main concern about this is the safety of the students.
Raymond Panzo is the principal and a teacher at Circle School, one of 6 schoolhouses scattered around the Yukon River north of Fairbanks.
I have 2 staff here who are not vaccinated. One is a teacher aide, and the other one is our custodian.
Lancaster says district officials realize it's important to talk with the 8 vaccine-hesitant employees before the district considers its next move.
There's many reasons that people are choosing not to be vaccinated. There's medical reasons, there's religious reasons, there's, you know, it's my body, my choice.
Lancaster says after the employees explain their reasoning, district officials may again urge them to get the shots, and then, based on their responses, will decide on how to proceed. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Last month, the city of Bethel told their employees that they could either get vaccinated against COVID-19, get an exemption, or lose their jobs. The remaining few unvaccinated employees are on administrative leave. As KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports, some are looking for new jobs.
When the vaccine mandate took effect, the city had 17 unvaccinated employees. The city's employees union tried to fight the vaccine mandate, but the city didn't budge. Since then, 2 of those employees quit, 1 got a religious exemption, and 10 got vaccinated. Now, 2.5 weeks after the vaccine mandate took effect, 4 unvaccinated employees remain. The city has placed them on an extended administrative leave in hopes that they'll get vaccinated and they won't have to fire them. I met 2 of these employees outside of the Bethel Job Center on a sunny afternoon. Jason Polk and Jim Bone of the Public Works Department still say they won't get the vaccine, so they're looking for new jobs. Polk is wearing his City of Bethel hat, and Bone's grandson waits in the truck, calling Appa in the background every so often. They've just finished applying for work inside. Here's Polk.
She asked me, like, what do you are interested in? And I told her various things. And we went through the computer and we picked out things. And there was things that had, like, heavy qualifications and stuff. I got a little bit of training in certain areas. Nothing compared to what a lot of them ask for nowadays.
Despite the advanced qualifications he says he's up against, he says he's not so nervous about trying to find a job. He figures, what good will worrying do? Polk says he doesn't want to get the vaccine because he's worried about its long-term effects, which he says can't be known yet. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the vaccines are safe and effective. 188 million Americans have gotten vaccinated against COVID-19. Financially, Polk says he'll be comfortable for a while. He started saving money when the city started asking questions about his vaccination status back in August.
Oh, we're just checking on who has the shot, who has their vaccination card, and who doesn't. I saw that coming. I was like, okay, I got this. Okay. I started putting away.
He doesn't foresee a future where every job he applies for requires the vaccine. Polk had his appointment scheduled at the same time as his good friend Jim Bone, also of the Public Works Department. Bone hasn't been saving.
Money-wise, it's going to be hard, you know, until we find a job for me, you know.
Bone says he won't get vaccinated because his wife would leave him if he does. I ask him what he'll do if all the jobs he'd be eligible for require vaccinations.
Hopefully it don't get that way, you know. You know, if it does, it does, you know. I'll just have to go survive on the land.
The employees have been on administrative leave for 3.5 weeks, along with another unvaccinated employee from Public Works. James Harris, the human resources director for the city of Bethel, said their first 2 weeks were paid because they first had to have a hearing with the city manager. He said they were owed due process. After the hearing, all three employees were then placed on a 30-day unpaid administrative leave.
I asked, why don't you just fire me? Get this over with.
Harris says it's because the city isn't, quote, heartless. The fourth unvaccinated city employee is an investigator in the Bethel Police Force. The city is allowing the state administrative court to handle his case. While he awaits his hearing, which is set for Monday, the city will continue to pay him his full salary, which is nearly $80,000 a year. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Fairbanks Memorial Hospital has set up a mobile morgue in the parking lot to prepare for any mass casualty event. As KUAC's Robin reports, the refrigerator container is not running yet, but it can be ready in 2 hours.
Foundation Health Partners used federal COVID grant money to buy a mobile refrigeration unit. It's been sitting ready in the south lot of Fairbanks Memorial Hospital since last December.
When we saw the surge with the Delta variant, we decided it was time to exercise that surge morgue capacity and make sure that if we needed it, we had moved it in place. We were able to power it appropriately and just make sure that the teams knew how to use it if we ever needed it.
Keith Fair, Director of Emergency Management for Foundation Health Partners, says it's a refrigerated Connex container. It looks like a standard storage container. He says the hospital moved it close to the building to get ahead of the snow.
We moved it in September into place and put a portable generator on it to make sure that it would work and did a systems check on it and spent time training our team so that they knew how to stand it up in a very short amount of time if it was necessary.
So far, it hasn't been necessary. The FMH morgue can hold 4 bodies and hasn't needed more capacity.
To my knowledge, the morgue capacity has never been overwhelmed at the hospital. We have a great relationship with our mortuary partners, and they come in and move the bodies out of the morgue and have been very timely about that.
The surge morgue can be fully functional within 2 hours and can hold 6 to 8 bodies.
Currently, we've got stretchers in place inside so that the bodies are treated appropriately. But with new grant funding that's coming, we'll be purchasing some racking that will allow us to appropriately treat up to 16 in that space.
Fear says the extra morgue capacity has been on a to-do list since a regulatory agency suggested it for the hospital in 2008. Regional hospitals are supposed to be prepared for mass casualty events like a chemical leak or a plane crash. And Fear says, because it's a federal asset, it can be shared with local emergency services at the site of an accident to quickly help with appropriate care. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson says his administration is working to bolster economic development in the city through upgrades at the Port of Alaska. Bronson delivered his State of the City address for the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce today. About 90% of goods consumed in Alaska, rural and urban, come through the port, and Bronson says it is in dire need of repairs.
Today, we are one seismic event away from catastrophic failure of our port.
As part of the Port of Alaska Modernization Program, Bronson says the municipality will replace aging infrastructure at the port like old docks and pilings. The beginnings of the project go back to at least 2014, when the port was called the Port of Anchorage. Bronson says his administration is working to secure funding to pay for the port improvements.
We are going to ask for a $165 million bond from the municipality of Anchorage, $250 million from the state of Alaska, and $750 million from the federal government. This is a big project.
Bronson said he hopes fixing the port will help to foster food security in Anchorage. During his remarks, Bronson also discussed the decrease in violent crime and the decrease in 911 wait times from the Anchorage Police Department He also talked about the Mass Care homeless facility in Anchorage and how his office and the Assembly are working on a unified approach to address homelessness.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the Union of Skilled Hands and Generous Hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message is sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
The Kenai City Council is holding off on accepting money from the National Library of Medicine until the Kenai Library can provide the council with a list of books it plans to get with the grant. The Kenai Library won $1,500 as part of a Collection Equity Outreach Award, geared toward funding library collections nationwide that focus on health equity. But at Wednesday's City Council meeting, multiple commenters said they worried about accepting the grant from the federal government. Dave Peck of Kenai said he's concerned about the use of the word equity in the award description.
I think equity can create division rather than unity. And I'm wondering if this is enhancing some sort of a federal agenda or requirements that are attached to this money, which would not necessarily represent the views of the people of Kenai or even the city council.
The ordinance says the city will focus on purchasing materials, quote, for underrepresented groups based on census data and informal community conversations. In her letter to the council, librarian Katia Wolf said health literacy is an important factor in reducing health disparities. She said she plans to buy books on topics including self-care and healthy habits, as well as books on specific medical conditions like cancer. City Manager Paul Ostrander said decisions about books are left to the discretion of the librarian.
I wanted you to know that there's already every year over $60,000 worth of books that she purchases. And I do think that looking at each one of those title by title and determining which are or are not appropriate is a very slippery slope that we need to be careful of.
The council agreed to postpone the ordinance until the first meeting of November, until the librarian can come up with a list of titles she will buy with the grant. The Dixon Glacier near Kachemak Bay is rapidly receding. That's true for glaciers around Alaska and the world, but what's special about Dixon is it sits just a few miles from Bradley Lake, a source of hydropower that supplies the rail belt with about 10% of its energy needs. And as the glacier keeps retreating, the Alaska Energy Authority, which owns the project, says it can expand the project's capacity using the new water coming off the glacier. KDLL's Sabine Pooks reports.
Brentwood Higman is a geologist based in Seldovia, not far from the glacier.
If you're talking in terms of geologic timescales, it's definitely rapidly retreating. I mean, it's something that if you went and visited the glacier 2 years in a row, and stood right next to it, it'd be pretty obvious that it was different.
Dixon Glacier has receded enough in the last 5 years so that there's now an exposed stream on state land. It's appealing to the Alaska Energy Authority, which has been eyeing ways to expand the 120-megawatt Bradley Lake project. Bradley Lake is the largest hydroelectric facility in Alaska, and it sends powers to utilities across the rail belt. Its power is also cheaper than other sources at 4 cents per kilowatt hour. Alaska Energy Authority Executive Director Curtis Thayer says diverting water from Dixon could bolster the project's capacity by 50%.
If Bradley can produce, now it produces 10, but if it produces 15 or 16% of renewable on the rail belt, that's huge.
The corporation recently wrapped up another expansion project, a 3-year effort to divert runoff from Battle Creek into Bradley Lake. That project grew the production capacity of the facility by 10%. Higman says, in a broad sense, energy providers can anticipate changes in the amount of water that becomes available for hydropower projects as glaciers continue to melt. And he says it could be valuable for them to anticipate how that changing landscape might affect their portfolios.
Bradley's already a critical part of our power infrastructure, and it'd be really nice to know how we might expect that to change as we're doing things like developing wind that might be balanced against Bradley.
An Alaska Energy Authority analysis from earlier this year places the Dixon project price tag at $125 million. Thayer says Alaska Energy Authority is considering a few ways to do the project.
We could do it. We could divert it into Bradley Lake, or maybe even do what we call a runner river, where we put a generator on the river that is currently outflowing and create power and ship the power off and let the water still continue to go out into Ketchmack Bay.
He says it could be up to a decade before the Alaska Energy Authority brings the Glacier Project online. By then, there's no telling how much more melted the Dixon Glacier will be. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Archipelago Lot 2A. That's the name of a prominent public space along downtown Juneau's waterfront that few people know. Officials with Juneau Docks and Harbors think they've got a better name that fits with some new public art. It would also help teach throngs of cruise ship visitors a little about Alaska civil rights history. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
You want to do another ride?
4-year-old Emmett Heimbigner is doing some wobbly laps on a bike that recently got pedals.
I am Emmett, and I've learned to ride a bike, and I haven't done it by myself.
His dad's keeping an eye on him, and so is Alaska civil rights leader Elizabeth Paratrovich in a giant 3-story mural behind him.
Do you recognize her?
The decked-over lot along Juneau's Seawalk that Emmett is riding on could soon be renamed for her, Paratrovich Plaza. Juneau Docks and Harbors officials have been calling it the Archipelago Lot. That name seems to come from a boring legal description of the property. Kirby Day, who's worked for the cruise industry in Juneau for decades, says it's not well known.
When you say archipelago lot, no one really knows what that is or what that means.
That checked out with people walking by during the lunch hour on Thursday. Emmett's dad, for example, didn't know the archipelago name, but knew Paratrovich. Juneau Docks and Harbors officials want to rename the lot, both to fit with the new mural that was finished in September and to help people get around the waterfront better. Here's Docks and Harbors board member Mark Ridgway.
There's a natural flow to naming it Paratrovich Plaza, given the mural's existence there. And we're talking about people who were just walking off of a boat. I like it better than, say, the Norwegian Nook or the Carnival Corner or the P&O Outlook.
The board committee voted 7-1 on Wednesday to recommend the Juneau Assembly formally change the name. Ray Wilson was also walking the waterfront on Thursday. The Tlingit elder has lived in Juneau most of his life and wears a hat that says Native Veteran.
I think for a long time, the city of Juneau hadn't recognized the Native people and haven't given them enough credit for what they do and what they put into the pot, so to speak.
Wilson also has a fuzzy memory that he might be a distant relative of Elizabeth Paratrovich.
To include Paratrovich in Juneau history, it's a big step towards recognizing Native people.
The Docks and Harbors Board recommendation to rename the lot has to go through one more meeting before it goes to the Juneau Assembly. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Olivia Eberts in Bethel, Robin in Fairbanks, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau. If you want to send us a news tip, a question, or a comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.